The U.S. Open is underway at Shinnecock Hills in Southampton, New York, and the first round produced both a record performance and a controversy. Wyndham Clark shot a 64 to open. That's a remarkable score at Shinnecock, which is one of the more punishing layouts on the USGA circuit. But the story that everyone is talking about is Joaquin Niemann's two-stroke penalty for throwing his club after a bad shot. The USGA assessed that penalty under Rule 1.2, which covers serious misconduct. It is apparently the first time such a penalty has been applied in U.S. Open history, which tells you something about how severe the conduct was perceived to be.
Golf's relationship with conduct rules is interesting in this context. The sport has historically governed itself through a culture of self-policing. Players call penalties on themselves for rules violations that no one else observed. The formalization of a conduct penalty at the highest level of professional play sends a signal that the USGA is willing to act, which matters for how players calibrate their behavior going forward.
Drake's OVO brand is facing a $4.6 million lawsuit from an investment firm alleging default on loan obligations, while simultaneously Drake is reportedly in talks to sell a 50% stake to Authentic Brands Group. ABG is the company that owns, among other things, Reebok, Brooks Brothers, Forever 21, and Sports Illustrated. If that deal closes, it puts Drake's fashion and lifestyle brand inside one of the most aggressive brand acquisition and licensing companies in the world. ABG's model is to extract value from brand recognition through licensing rather than direct retail. So what OVO would look like as an ABG property is a genuinely open question.
The Kennedy Center requesting more time from a judge as its board weighs renovation options reflects the ongoing tension between the institution's artistic mission and its political governance. The Kennedy Center's board has been reshaped significantly under the current administration, and the renovation question is partly financial and partly about what the institution wants to be and represent going forward.
The Phil Mickelson story, his lawyer confirming he resigned from a club after misconduct allegations, is still unfolding, but it adds a layer of personal controversy to a career that has already had significant off-course drama, including his involvement in LIV Golf and prior insider trading allegations. Mickelson is one of the most decorated players in the sport's history, with 6 major championships. How this situation develops will affect both his legacy and his professional standing.
Now let's do something we've been building toward all episode, the what if we're wrong exercise. The most confident claim circulating right now is that the U.S.-Iran deal, for all its flaws, represents a genuine de-escalation that reduces the probability of regional conflict and ultimately benefits global oil markets by bringing more Iranian supply online. Markets have partially priced this in. Analysts are modeling the $105 billion in Iranian oil revenues as a realistic scenario.
Let me play advocate for the skeptical position, because I think the counterargument is stronger than the consensus narrative acknowledges. The assumption underneath the optimistic read of the deal is that Iran will honor its commitments, that the Strait of Hormuz transit permit demand is posturing rather than a genuine escalation, and that the diplomatic arrangement is durable enough to survive the first serious test. All 3 of those assumptions have historical precedents that cut the other direction. Iran walked away from the original JCPOA's spirit, though not its letter, within 2 years of signing it. The transit permit demand came within days of the ink drying on the current deal. And Trump-era agreements have historically been volatile because they depend on personal relationship dynamics rather than institutional frameworks.
What would need to be true for the pessimistic scenario to materialize? You'd need Iran to actually begin enforcing those transit permits, demanding payment from ships in a way that creates an incident. You'd need that incident to escalate before diplomatic channels can contain it. And you'd need the Netanyahu-Trump rift that we described earlier to deepen to the point where Israel takes unilateral action against Iranian targets, which would shatter the deal entirely.
The indicator to watch, the concrete signal that tells you the pessimistic scenario is live, is the 60-day grace period on transit permits. If Iran begins enforcing permit requirements on even a single commercial vessel after that grace period expires, you'll see 2 immediate market reactions. oil prices will spike above whatever the current baseline is, and shipping insurance rates in the Gulf will move dramatically. That's your signal. It won't be ambiguous. If those two things happen within a short window of each other, the optimistic read of this deal will need serious revision.
The deeper assumption worth examining is whether the administration's deal-making style, which prioritizes speed and personal relationships over institutional verification, is capable of producing durable outcomes in a region where the relevant parties have been in conflict for 40-plus years. The answer to that question is something we genuinely don't know yet. But anyone who tells you the Iran deal is definitely going to hold. The same way the 2015 JCPOA held for several years needs to account for the structural differences between the two agreements.